The Basics of Genetics, Lecture 14, Conclusions.
So we've come a long way since Gregor Mendel, and if he were alive today, he would be absolutely amazed at what happened with genetics. It amazes me every day that I get to teach this subject and to keep up with the reading on this and to try to understand it as best I can. It's a privilege. What I wanted to conclude with is something that takes us a little bit into the field of ethics, because that may have been a motivation to begin with for you to go through this set of lectures on genetics. It may be that you're hearing a great deal about genetics in the news and are sometimes called upon to make decisions and to make them ethically if possible, if that is the case. And I wanted to take us to a particular specific example of the challenge of mixing up politics and science that began to occur almost as soon as humans began to really understand what was going on with genes. And that is called eugenics, E-U-G-E-N-I-C-S, eugenics. An unfortunate mixing of politics and science, an unfortunate mixing up of political policies and science, and an unfortunate stretching and bending of scientific concepts such that the results in some cases were horrendous. But what I want to do is take us back a little bit through the history of that so that we can understand eugenics as having developed fairly logically for a period of time out of what people thought they were understanding about genetics. And then we'll talk about how things went bad. And then we'll talk about perhaps some relevant topics today that still can be put under the rubric of eugenics, although they seldom are, because the word, of course, has acquired such a distasteful and negative connotation, as well it should. The concept of eugenics, the word eugenics, was developed in the 1880s by Francis Galton, who was a cousin of Charles Darwin, and who was greatly influenced by Charles Darwin, and who understood as best he could what Charles Darwin was saying about natural selection as the source of the origin of species. Remember, Darwin did not understand much of anything about genetics, but he certainly had some excellent ideas about how species might have originated even without genetics. And the purpose of Francis Galton was perhaps fairly innocent at first. He wanted to improve humans. He wanted to lessen human suffering by disease. He wanted to increase the intelligence and strength of humans. And he wanted to conserve resources that might be used to used to help humans who perhaps were suffering from disease or had some other particular sorts of problems. How he wanted to go about that in the 1880s, this is Francis Galton, he wanted to do it by a sort of mechanism of selection, and I put selection in quotes here in my notes because he didn't quite mean it selection as strongly as what we do when we domesticate an animal or a plant, but he did want to use something like selection similar to what we do when we domesticate or improve an animal or a plant, improve to our mind, whatever improve means. And so out of that came a series of eugenic practices that ranged all the way from mild to extreme. And I'm going to take you through a list that I compiled of what I mean by these particular practices. And as I'm going through the list, and it's in order of more or less mild to extreme, think as we're going through where we would draw the line and at what point are we on a slippery slope? At what point are we at a point where we are beyond what humans should be doing? And how do we determine what a good human trait is? That's also a very important thing. When I say we're improving animals and plants by domestication, well, perhaps we are, perhaps we are not. We can debate that. But what do we mean when we say we're selecting for good human traits? Now, the important thing that probably comes to mind when I said eugenics at the beginning was what happened in Nazi Germany. And I don't want to limit it just to Nazi Germany because I'm afraid that lets everyone else a little too easily off the hook. And I think it's maybe a mistake if we're trying to really talk about this in a more holistic way to dismiss eugenics as a terrible mistake made by a relatively few people in a very specific place and time, and to sort of leave us maybe not culpable for aspects of what happened. In fact, during the same time that horrendous things were happening in Nazi Germany in the name of eugenics, many American and European geneticists were interested in eugenics and were actually doing some practices that may surprise you if you don't already know what they are, and which I'll be describing to you. They ranged all the way from celebrating what they considered to be positive choices for mates. In other words, let's have the best people getting together and having lots of kids, and let's celebrate that, and let's advertise that, and let's make a big deal of that, and let's discourage any sorts of relationships that might result in what we would consider to be negative qualities, to actually having social policies causing certain categories of people to be less able to get together and mate, get married, have kids. So let me go through this list here, keeping in mind that the first few items on the list are fairly innocuous. And in fact, I've ordered this in the order in which I certainly could be participating in some of these things if the circumstances were right. First on the list is genetic counseling. Nothing wrong with that. Nothing wrong with going to a genetic counselor and getting some good advice about what to do if you're carrying, for example, that Tay-Sachs gene that we talked about in an earlier lecture, or understanding something more about a particular other gene mutation that your family might be carrying. Next on the list, prenatal testing. Testing of eggs or embryos, and then making a decision as to what to do. Do you get an abortion? Do you carry on? Do you simply prepare for what will be the result if there is a mutation that is detected? So prenatal testing fits along this slope that we're going to move along. Abortion. Gene therapies. If they work, and gene therapies are still a very new thing, but there may come a day where someone will test an egg and say, oh, this is a future diabetic. Can we right now go in and repair that gene so this child will not get diabetes? Designer gene therapies, if they work, and right now these are just in the imagination of geneticists for the most part, but saying, well, I see that we've got a mutation to the gene in the pathway that is going to cause this child to be of normal height, except there's a mutation such that the child will be of less than normal height. Should we go in and do something that's more akin to designer gene therapy? In other words, manipulating things that are not life or death situations or are not serious medical conditions. Next step, any aspect of cloning. If it works, and I've already talked about cloning throughout this, cloning is something that is currently being done with pets and currently being done with domestic animals. It will be possible at some point for a person to decide that they want to take one of their cells, one of the nuclei from one of their cells, one of their sets of DNA, and implant it into a brand new egg, someone else's egg perhaps, or their own egg, and to essentially get what is clone-like. Throughout this course, I've argued that we should be careful about how we talk about that word, but something clone-like. How about the use of sperm banks and egg banks? How about the use of sperm banks in which someone has told, truthfully or not, that they are Nobel Prize winners and that perhaps your children, if they come from the sperm bank, are going to have some aspect of whatever genes are in those Nobel Prize winners. How about any sort of in vitro fertilization or other fertility assisting type technologies? What about birth control? Now, an interesting thing about Margaret Sanger, who was one of the originators and proponents of birth control policies, is that she was part of the early eugenics movement. And one of the original ideas of the early eugenicists, and I'm not talking just about Nazi Germany by any means, I mean throughout Europe and throughout the United States, was that perhaps birth control might be a way to help to control less desirable populations of people with presumably less desirable genetic traits, so that people with more desirable traits could be free to reproduce as abundantly as they wished. So here's the point where I begin to draw the line. Birth control for myself? Sure. Birth control imposed on somebody else? Here's where I've drawn a line across my notes and said, well, possibly this is the point where we start to get onto the slippery slope. So now let's step to the other side of that line, the other side of the line in which you begin to impose birth control on other people because you have decided that their traits really should not be carried along. People perhaps that are considered to be mentally defective or with some sort of criminal aspect to their life, some people who are institutionalized, people who are in other sort of circumstances where possibly their birth control situation could be controlled by others. We step over the line now, perhaps. There are religious sects that shun or oust members who are not like themselves or who are not participating in the way that they should be, so that they no longer get to become part of that pool of genes, perhaps. There are marriage laws, some still on the books, that prevent marriages between certain people in the name of eugenics in some cases. There are policies, in some cases still on the books, of institutionalizing people, thereby preventing marriages and producing children by those people. Healthcare is limited and probably has a future of continuing to be limited and could be limited by group. Who gets the healthcare? Who doesn't get it? Limiting immigration was one of the most popular ways for the United States and Europe to participate in the eugenics movement. And limiting immigration by nationality, in limiting immigration by abilities, ability to read or write or do other things, was part of the eugenics movement in the early part of the 20th century in the United States. Selective abortion applied to other people. Sterility programs applied to other people. And both of those were practiced in the United States in the early 20th century. Forced emigration, forcing certain groups of people to leave the country. Here's where we start to approach some of the things that led us into World War II and caused Nazi Germany to be such a disaster. Forced emigration, transportation of people, infanticides, killing of infants, and there are plenty of things we could say about that, so I will leave it for you to consider those. Euthanasia. Where does it fit in? What are we talking about with euthanasia? And is it voluntary or not? And then, of course, we get into genocides. And we have perhaps ad hoc genocides, but then we have systematic genocides. So we're well into the slippery slope there, and we're right up to the horrors of Nazi Germany. But what I will say is that many of the things at the beginning of the list are part of the overall desire to control our own genetics, or to control the genetics of others, or to make the world perhaps a better place, but to make it a better place but by whatever our definition of that is. So there are things to think about, and perhaps this course has given you some extra terminology and concepts by which a few of these things could be discussed. So what I'd like to do finally is review a little bit about where we've been with this course. And where we've been is through many, many topics, often at a fairly introductory level. But nonetheless, here's what I think you can come away with from this course. And I would include with that, by the way, looking through the course booklet, reading through the course booklet to reinforce some of the concepts. So first of all, you can recognize some aspects of those Mendelian ratios. You have some understanding of how simple genetic traits, simplified as Mendel did, work as they're passed down from parent to offspring. So I would say that you understand some aspects of simple Mendelian genetics, which is a great place to start. That's the ideal place, I think, to start a genetics course. More importantly, you understand the idea of traits as spectrums of possibilities in multigenetic pathways, where many of the genes can be represented as allele series, Okay, all I need to say to you is Cookie Factory, and you know what I'm talking about, but it's also dog colors. You understand that these are not simple yes or no types of questions, that we have a wonderful range and spectrum of possibilities because of the complexity in which genes interact, and it's maybe one of the most important take-home stories from this course. At this point, I'm hoping that you always think of genes in context of environment, and that you have a broad definition of environment that includes not only the obvious things like what the external environment for an organism is, but other genes are part of the environment of a gene. The cellular environment, the tissue environment, the environment in the uterus of an organism, the environment in respect to interactions with other organisms, and that you have a nice complex picture, as it really should be, for talking about environment and genetics. I hope that you've come away with a better understanding of what it means to have an X and what it means to have a Y chromosome. We covered a number of topics with that. I told you about what we understand is on the Y chromosome. It's a great example of gene regulation. And we talked a little bit about the X chromosome and one of the consequences being how we get calico cats. I hope you never look at calico cats the same way again, because you've got a wonderful example right there of the kind of mosaic effect that you get when one or another of the X chromosomes is turned off. And calico cats are my favorite example of that. At this point, you are beginning to recognize, or at least make good educated guesses about really complicated mutations involving the grammar of the cell, these major regulatory type mutations, because you know that the dog breeds are wonderful examples of that. If you see a dog with short legs or a nose that is not elongated like a wolf nose, or with some kind of peculiar aspect to the tail, or the ears are not quite the shape, remember, you're always deriving this from what a wolf looks like. So pretty much any major morphological deviation from a wolf, and you're looking at the kind of mutation that we were talking about when we talked about the regulation of the grammar of DNA. You can begin to talk about and recognize perhaps the sorts of things that can occur if there are differences in mitochondria and differences in chloroplasts. And I always like plant variegation for an example of that. But perhaps you also understand enough about the way mitochondria work to be able to say something about how those are passed along in a maternal way. So it's a different sort of inheritance. And in fact, it's sometimes traditionally called non-Mendelian inheritance. I think Mendel would have loved it if he could have seen how that worked out. But it's traditionally called non-Mendelian inheritance when we talk about mitochondria and chloroplasts being passed down maternally like that. And at this point, you can recognize the possible influence of viruses or jumping genes on traits, especially if you look at plants. And you have a great deal of power with that, because they're very popular. Horticulturalists love variegated plants, and you now have a better idea of how that wonderful variegation occurs, and even why it's considered to be a non-stable trait. Remember, that's one of your key words as you're looking through plant catalogs or talking to plant horticulturalists. If it's a non-stable trait, then you have even a better possibility of saying then it's something to do with something viral or jumping gene-like. And in general, I hope you have a growing appreciation for the importance of DNA mutations and DNA variability, and why it's a very positive concept in spite of whatever negative connotations sometimes occur with words like that, because it's part of the natural variability of DNA and part of the natural variability of organisms worldwide. And it's really how evolution has worked and why there's such amazing things to see when you look out at almost any group of organism. Here's another topic that has been throughout these lectures. Topic is cloning. We began talking about it at the very beginning when I said essentially what Mendel was working with was clones. And we even went through the history of the use of the word clone, and it has a fairly innocuous history. It begins with all sorts of methods of propagating plants, but it's come to mean something more. And I want to put together some of the ideas that we've had thus far in the course. I've mentioned cloning a number of times and said at one point we're going to just try to wrap all of these up. Cloning may become, for humans, part of the repertoire of things that we already do to assist humans in fertility. You can go to a fertility clinic and there are all sorts of possible solutions to whatever the nature of the problem is, whether it's sperm donors or egg donors or surrogate mothers or any combination of things that can occur. And I suspect that one of the places where cloning could end up is under the rubric of things that we do to help people with fertility, although there may be some other aspects of this as well that we can address at the end. But first, let's think of it as something that you might do to assist somebody with fertility problems. Also, consider a clone to be perhaps not that much different from an identical twin that originated when there was one fertilized egg that went through a division, its very first division, but instead of those two new cells sticking together and forming the basis of a human, those cells separated and became future identical twins. They became two separate individuals, but with identical DNA. So a clone of a human, a clone of a pet, is not too much different from an identical twin. That said, there are all kinds of reasons for identical twins to not necessarily be absolutely identical. And here's what I want to go through. All sorts of reasons, too, why what you might think of as a clone, namely something that's identical, might not, in fact, be identical. Now, maybe that's not what people are going for in a fertility clinic. Maybe all of this is a moot point. Maybe you're just trying to figure out a way to get someone in offspring in the next generation, and it just happens to be your own DNA that you're using. So perhaps this is important, perhaps it isn't for a fertility clinic, but here are the reasons that identical twins are not necessarily identical, and a clone is not necessarily an identical individual to the one that donated the DNA. First of all, think about what you know about genes. Think about what you know about genes and the array of alleles that could possibly exist for those genes, and those genes interacting in pathways and doing amazingly complex things to give us the traits. So far, so good for identical. So identical twins are probably going to have identical genes and identical alleles of those genes, and more or less identical activities of those genes in pathways, more or less identical. So far, so good. I think at that level, we can be fairly confident in saying, yes, these are identical individuals. It begins to get complicated when we bring in the grammar part of how those genes are used. So the thing about grammar is, I said, it's the metaphor by which I talk about gene regulation, and it allows me to also make some connections between natural languages and gene regulation. And I said, among other things, when a cell is going full force, organizing all of its genes, making all these decisions, it's almost like cocktail party chatter. There's a noise level in the room so that individual conversations maybe need to be repeated. Maybe people don't hear each other quite right. Perhaps people have to shout a little bit or say again in a different way what they meant in order for the message to get across. And if you think of all those competing discussions going on as the cell is organizing itself, they probably will not get repeated identically in an identical twin or in a clone. Here's where I think we begin to get the first level of the kind of differences that we're talking about. So there'll be slightly different conversations, things repeated in slightly different ways, in slightly different combinations of grammar, because it's just as loose as a natural language. There are a lot of ways to get the answer, and it's not necessarily one particular formulaic set of grammar that's going to give us a complete organism. So there's the first place where a clone is not necessarily going to be a clone, and an identical twin is not necessarily going to be an identical twin. And that actually connects up with what you understand about the environment. Because the genes that are involved with that grammar are often exquisitely tuned into the environment. It's the environment in part that helps to tell those regulatory genes how to organize the grammar of the cell. That is, they're in tune with the environment and making little adjustments accordingly. And recall that the environment is complicated. Perhaps the clone is a clone that was made inside of a different egg. That would certainly have to be the case if it were a clone of a man, because a man doesn't have eggs. So that clone would have to be a clone inside of an egg from a donor. Then you've got the environment of the uterus, which, again, in the case of a man, couldn't possibly be that man's uterus since he doesn't have one, or it could be a much older woman who couldn't carry a baby, or a much younger individual who could not carry a baby. So it might well be a surrogate uterus in which this new clone is going to be carried. And then, of course, you've got the entire environment of the whole body beyond the uterus, the way that possibly surrogate mother is metabolizing things and interacting with her world. And then, of course, you've got the world beyond, and there's no guarantee whatsoever it's going to be identical. You can do something like that in a laboratory. White rats in a laboratory are often in nearly identical environments. They're all in identical cages, getting identical food and water, but certainly we won't do anything remotely like that with humans. And then, furthermore, this new person, this new clone, is going to grow up in a very different world and probably no way to reproduce the sorts of learning experience, the sorts of interactions with friends and family that the original person who donated the DNA had. And does this matter? It might matter quite a bit. Although, again, if we're talking about a fertility clinic where people are just trying to reproduce, perhaps it doesn't matter too much. But these are some of the things that make a clone not a true clone. But there's more. We talked about X inactivation, and I said that it was a very poor choice to begin with a calico female cat as our first wonderful example of a cloned pet, because that was doomed to a kind of interesting failure, a kind of a fun failure to talk about, actually, and that is X inactivation happens, and so one or the other of the X's all over the body of the cat is inactivated, and it's random. Now, you might have been thinking, okay, but that's just orange and black genes. That wouldn't matter for maybe more important genes, and color is a pretty superficial trait. But let me remind you that the X chromosomes have thousands of genes, many of which have very profound and important functions in the cell. I mentioned color blindness, I mentioned hemophilia, but there are thousands more. And so what you should think of when you think of a calico cat is that's just the superficial indicator of underlying complexity that results from X inactivation. So it's not a trivial example. It means that any female that is cloned or any identical twin females will have different patterns of X inactivation. So problems with males, problems with females with cloning, different sorts of problems. Males that they're unlikely to be cloned into an egg since males don't have eggs, and females with X inactivation. And then there's maternal inheritance. So remember, we are filled with complex cell compartments, including mitochondria, including all sorts of other things that go along with a fully functional cell, and that these are passed down maternally from the mother through the size of the egg compared with the size of the sperm. So here's a potential problem. Is it a surrogate cell that the DNA is going into? And does it make a difference if you might end up with a different set of mitochondria or a different set of other cell components? And it might well. Remember, the mitochondria are easy to take for granted because they're so important. It's like the furnace in the basement of your house that as long as it's working, you don't even bother going down to look and take a look at it and see how it's doing. It's just making heat and doing what it ought to be doing. So it's only when things go wrong that suddenly you notice that you have these mitochondria that are doing these absolutely pivotal things. So it might make a difference, the maternal inheritance of all that goes with an egg. And then finally, we talked about viruses and transposons. And I said we were absolutely filled with them, viruses and jumping genes. Transposon is one of the technical words for jumping gene. Viruses and jumping genes. And I said that we were absolutely filled with them, and they're not pathogens. And for the most part, they're benign. They're staying in place. They're quietly going along with whatever replication is going on with our DNA. But they are capable of some movements, and there's evidence that every generation, there's a few more movements of particular ones that are able to do that. And there's no guarantee that they're going to move and interact in exactly the same way that they did in the identical twin or in the individual that was cloned. And this could be a huge factor in how that DNA actually ends up being used. So all of those point to cloning as yet another way for humans to reproduce, and perhaps that's not a bad thing. We've got a long list of ways that humans assist themselves and get assisted in reproduction. And this becomes yet another way to do that, but perhaps also creates some false hopes about getting absolutely identical twin-like reproduction, assuming that's even a goal for anyone. It also leads to all sorts of interesting questions, some of which are in the news. For example, would it be right to create a clone, not so much because you're in a fertilization clinic or a fertility clinic, but rather because you'd like to have a clone of yourself so that you have some spare parts for organ donation? And in here, I think we start to get down that same interesting slippery slope that I talked about in terms of eugenics. I'm not going to go through a whole list for this, but you could almost begin to create the list yourself. At what point do we draw the line? Fertility clinics are one thing. Having some extra parts that would be compatible with you were you to ever need an organ transplant is maybe crossing the line, maybe heading a little too far down that slippery slope. So all sorts of interesting things, but I think the most important thing that you carry away from this course is some real baseline information that sometimes is missing from news stories. Sometimes there's a kind of a cavalier use of the word clone, as though we should all know immediately what it was and then jump right to the conclusions that we need to make about whether it's ethically right to do this or that with a clone. So I think the most important thing you're taking away here is an understanding of real the real basics of cloning and what it means. So this concludes our course in genetics, and I thank you very much for listening all the way to the end. And I have enjoyed putting this together and revisiting many of my favorite topics in genetics, and there are quite a few of them. And I hope this has inspired you to think about particular aspects that you'd like to look into more yourself. There are plenty of things that you can read, suggested readings at the end of each of the chapters, lots of ways for you to go and extend any particular topic in any way that you want. And I hope that this course has inspired you and given you the confidence to do exactly that.
This ends Lecture 14. This course, produced by John J. Alexander, is copyrighted 2007 by Recorded Books, LLC. The lecture text is copyrighted 2007 by Betsy Dexter Dyer. The lectures were edited under the direction of Ian McCulloch.